The best way to predict the future is to invent it. Stephen Ambrose brings you up to speed on what the future holds as he explores the latest technology as it impacts our lives.
Well, good morning and welcome to Tech Talk right here on Chai FM. And as usual, we're trying to collate and update and understand some of the craziest things that are going on in the technology world. And simply put, all of these things affect us every single day. Everyone's got a phone in their hand. Everyone's connecting, messaging, phoning, video tweeting, you name it, WhatsApping, buying from Shane and Temu, more about that later. And just generally, it's almost ridiculous how much we are connected to everything or how much we rely on those connections to keep our modern lives in check and to handle our crazy schedules and plan a holiday. There's almost no part of what we do that is not being touched, all the way down to sport and exercise. Vast number of people I know have all got their smartwatches, their smart readers, their trackers on, or at the very least, they pop a tracker into their pocket. So if they're out running, someone knows where they are. So technology really has touched absolutely every part of our lives. And here's what's so interesting. Mobile technology was the final catalyst that made so many of these things possible. Without the smartphone, without mobile tech, mobile connectivity, a huge chunk of what we take utterly for granted today just wouldn't happen. And mobile has really grown and changed over the years. And the latest news is that 2G, but not 2G so much, but 3G as a technology has been slated for shutdown by 2027. Now, when you think about that, we're in the middle of 2024, 2025's around the corner. So it's not very long before these networks would be effectively outlawed in South Africa and most of the world. And for the most part, they've gone down because simply they're not worth keeping alive. The valuable spectrum and the inefficient use of spectrum certainly doesn't work very well for the mobile networks, and the far more advanced 4G, 4G plus, 5G, and soon to be announced 6G networks are way better at managing the sheer quantity of usage and data that's going through these networks. And 2G and 3G have become anachronisms. How's that for a good one? So for the most part, all the networks are aware of what attaches to the 2G network. And for the most, and again, it's mostly for voice on 2G, those old dumb phones, which there are a ton of. Interestingly, many countries still have a much higher penetration of smart devices, which are generally 4G and above compatible. But there are a ton of simple dumb phones that can send an SMS, make a phone call, and they're all based on either the 2G or 3G technology. Well, the first step of that is they're going to effectively ban the sale of those devices in the nearish future. That doesn't mean that there aren't millions, if not tens of millions, of those devices floating about. Some of them, like the old Nokias, just refuse to die. There's batteries available from third-party suppliers, so you can carry on using them. But effectively, 2G and 3G will be switched off in the next 18 to 2 years, and it's going to affect a whole lot of little things, mostly low-end smart or non-smart devices. But also, there are a lot of older IoT or 10-year-old type connecting devices that use machine-to-machine communication using 2G or 3G networks. And apparently the networks know, obviously they know, because those devices connect. So they know where they are, they know what they're doing. And they are connecting or contacting all these people and asking them to update, change, and move. These things take time. But simply put, 2G and 3G is going the way of analog records. Well, there's a revival of that, but they're pretty much obsolete in today's world, and expect to see a lot of chatter about it over the next little while. It shouldn't affect most people who are using a smartphone. In fact, hardly any, because some of the smartphones are no longer updating. They're hardly worth using if they couldn't do 4G and above. So basically, they're going to fade away, disappear, and we won't be able to 2G or 3G anymore. And moving on to something I mentioned, Shane and Temu, they're under big fire because essentially the it's almost impossible. They spent hundreds of millions of rands on marketing globally, if not billions. It was impossible to open up a social media or any form of platform and not be bombarded with these like ridiculous offers from these two Chinese retailers. And for the most part, it's the most downloaded app for all of us over the last little while. And Takealot and a lot of South African local retailers have been suffering a lot from it because the clothing is super cheap. Their process was super slick. You could return what you wanted. You could buy stuff for ridiculously low prices. If it didn't fit, it was hardly even a problem. But that model was based on a little loophole in the Tax Act that has come to light. And that was that for any parcel under 500 Rand, you would only pay 20% customs duty, and you wouldn't pay VAT of 15%. And they would sneak those through en masse or in bulk and then ship them off to you because individually there was cheap enough to do that. So they were paying way less duty than all the other retailers who were buying their products through other people and paying 45% tax plus 15% VAT. So if you think about it, there was a difference of nearly 40% in taxes between Shane and Temu and any other retailer in South Africa. Well, SARS have announced that from now, and I think in the next week or so, they're going to be upping the duty to 45%, like everyone, and adding VAT even on these small little parcels. So effectively, you can expect the pricing of Shane and Temu products to jump by at least 60%. And remember, that's 60% on the selling price. So by the time you finished, it adds up quite quickly. So imagine you've got to pay for every 100 Rand another 60 Rand odd in duties and VAT. So that's a big jump in pricing, and it should level the playing fields. Now, many, many people I've spoken to have been crying foul and saying, this is not fair, and how can you do this? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But it does in terms of the simple fact is that Takealot and all the local, even Amazon.com, although there is a rumor that Amazon.com are coming back at Shane and Temu quite hard with their own range of low-cost clothing and everything in a similar sort of way. They've got the purchasing power to do it. But it did represent a massive distortion in the market. It represented, in many ways, a really unfair advantage. And the whole question of these massive duties and taxes and everything is a whole discussion for another type of show. But the simple fact is, if all the major retailers and operators within a territory like South Africa were paying, let's say, 60% total taxes on something, and someone came along and found a loophole to not pay those taxes, it would put them at an incredibly unfair advantage. And at the end of the day, both these companies do not employ, nor set up, nor manage large numbers of people or bring a lot of value to the South African economy. They simply ship goods from China via a courier, and don't want to take anything away from those guys. They're entitled to make a living. But still, it seems that the day of super cheap clothing from Temu and Shane and all the other little gizmos and gadgets you buy are finished. Not that in many respects the pricing is going to be that bad. It was so ridiculously cheap. And we're talking about silly prices for so many apparently very decent quality products. I've bought a few myself, and I've been very, very pleased with the overall quality. But the market has spoken, or rather the government has spoken, and the market has accepted that those days of super cheap, super easy, and super simple Temu and Shane products just arriving magically after a few days at incredibly low prices are over, and you're going to see more and more of pricing parity across the online shops, which in a way is not a bad thing, but for our pockets, it could be a little bit of a challenge. But anyway, there's been a lot of movement elsewhere before we have our break for big discussion about all the Apple intelligence that's coming our way in the next little while. Luckily, we're not Europe, but because not coming there for a bit. But I'll be back with that in a few minutes. However, before we get there, the good news is a little bit of a war is breaking out between MTN and Vodacom, and we're going to see a lot of activity in that space. Hopefully, it's all about spectrum at the moment, but hopefully the resolution of all the spectrum allocation and everything will result in slightly better, faster, simpler operation, as well as a reduction in data prices. I won't talk about voice prices. I mean, who doesn't use WhatsApp to do all their calling? So expect to see a lot of press, a lot of hoo-ha about Vodacom and MTN and all the various spectrum pooling arrangements that have been approved by ICASA over the last little while. And MTN has been pretty aggressive. They've amassed big pools of precious spectrum. And spectrum is limited. Spectrum is what is used to transmit the radio signals. And the man with more spectrum always wins. They can be faster, they can be cheaper, and the maths just works so extremely well. So we'll be back with the story about Apple in a minute.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Well, welcome back. And in the last few weeks, as part of our Tech Talk Cafe segment, there has been some enormous moves from Apple into the AI world. Now, AI has been all over the news for the last 18 months. It pretty much only became known in November of 2022. But by November of 2023, 1 year later, everybody was in on AI, mostly talking about generative AI, the so-called large language models or LLMs. But essentially, chatbots would never be the same again. You could type in, now you can write in, you can request the most ridiculous amounts of information in very creative ways, and your AI would go off and generate pictures, create music, do what you want, write blogs. In fact, we tried. It didn't work terribly well because it isn't quite as adept at talking about technology as me, thank God for now, because soon you'll have an AI tech talk coming your way without any humans. We're hoping that's not going to happen soon, but you never know in this day and age. But simply put, for the most part, AI was dominated by the Googles, the Microsofts, and other external, the ChatGPT models. And this became something that was integrated into Word. It was integrated into every browser. And it just suddenly became something that everybody was using, talking about, and it was helping do so many different things. We're not going into the nuts and bolts of the whole thing, but simply put, Google and Samsung launched their smart AI-powered S24 phone in early January, and, you know, Circle to Search, and so many other automatic translation. There were so many cool features that used to use separate apps and now suddenly built into the operating system and became almost second nature to use. And the benefit, or the beauty and benefit of these platforms, was that you hardly noticed that you were using them. They just either auto-corrected and fixed your grammar, or suggested some new ways, or changed the tone of what you wrote, or searched for goodies in a way that was just intuitive and simple. You saw a flower, you didn't know what the name was, you circled the picture, and it told you the whole story about the genus and what it is, and, you know, information probably way more than you need. But simply put, the world became a lot easier to navigate. Information became a lot easier to understand and to obtain. Natural language became the way that you could ask any platform for information, and that extended more and more into business. So many business operations could be simplified by simply asking for what you were looking for, rather than having to know some sort of coding language and run a query to get certain information. So AI and generative AI and the general use of smart, intelligent platforms was very quickly becoming the way that everybody did business. And the adage was, and many are saying this, AI is not going to steal your job, but people who know how to use AI might. So I think we have to really realize that this is a bit of a paradigm shift. It's definitely moved the way that we do things in many respects, certainly in the way we operate, the way we interact with technology, and the way that we run and manage our businesses has shifted. Now, Apple, in true Apple fashion, tended to be a little behind the curve in terms of announcing this. iOS 17 and even the latest versions of iOS did not have any form of AI built in. There were a lot of apps you could download on iOS, which allowed you, you could download the ChatGPT app. There were other apps, browsers that you could download that gave you some of the benefits, and other keyboard helpers that had AI built in. Many apps like the Word app had AI built in, but inherently the Apple model did not have AI as a base product in any way, shape, or form. Well, at their WWDC, which is their Worldwide Developer Conference, which happens every year around about June, early-ish June, that all changed with the announcement of something they call Apple Intelligence. And I must admit, it's very clever. If you think about it, Apple Intelligence, the acronym is AI. But it works perfectly. And in fact, is a lot cleverer and subtly more smart way of talking about AI as calling it intelligence rather than AI as most people see, because it's not artificial intelligence at this stage. It is simply a highly sophisticated form of machine intelligence. So here we go. Let's again not get into that. But what they have done from the base up, and I'm already playing with a version of iOS 18, one of their beta, to understand and how and see how it all works. But from the base up, what Apple has done has it has integrated intelligence into the base operating system. So there is no separate app per se. There's no separate ChatGPT style methodology. Every single element, every single app that Apple makes, every single process such as Siri and all the things we've come to take for granted has now got Apple Intelligence fused in. And one of the biggest challenges around AI, and something that a lot of people forget about, is when you go into your browser and you open up your ChatGPT browser prompt, and you go to ChatGPT and you upload information and you ask the AI to help you rephrase it or to sort it or to analyze it or to create a spreadsheet from it or whatever you do in the AI model, that information that you upload goes into the cloud. It goes to servers somewhere where the algorithms and the processing sits. And those algorithms use that information, like a human being would do, to learn and to train itself and to deliver you results based on other people's information and all the information it's gathered and send it back to you. The problem with that is if you're uploading confidential information, there is every chance that that confidential information, one, machines never forget. So whatever you upload is stored somewhere. Whatever is learned by the AI is replicated across any user of that AI, because you can't tell the AI, sorry, just use this information only for me and no, for no one else. It's part of the agreement when you start using the AI. So many companies have banned the use of AI for that simple reason. If you've got a whole 500-page document which you want to summarize, there's nothing slicker than loading it into an AI platform and asking for a detailed and point-by-point one-page summary. It's excellent at running through it, figuring out what's important and giving you a summary. The challenge is that document now resides completely and utterly in the AI platform for everyone to use. And if you're really smart, there's ways to retrieve that information through the system. So companies have stopped it. However, there's another discussion we'll have there. But this was identified as part of the base security issues around artificial intelligence. And Apple have come up with a brilliant way of getting around that. And that is something that a lot of companies are also doing. They've got their own version of the algorithm that only trains on the data you put in and then runs on the device that you're using and never sends that information off to another place or another storage system or another platform. So it can never be seen or shared. So what Apple have promised is AI or intelligence in a very privacy-friendly way. And what that means is that all the AI models run locally on your device as much as possible. And if they need to use one of the cloud servers for whatever reason, there's not enough memory or there's not enough capacity or can't perform the function you've requested, it will then ask you if you want to send that data to another server, and it will then track and manage that that data is removed and not stored on that server going forward. So for all external AI models that are integrated into the intelligence platform, you have to actually give permission. So for example, ChatGPT is integrated into Siri, and you can use it to write, you can use it to do all sorts of things on your conversations and whatever you want to do with Siri, but you have to give explicit permission that it can use your data for that purpose. And it's very clear that any data that is used is now available within the ChatGPT intelligence brain, wherever that may reside, and may be used for many, many things. The downside of this capacity to process on device is that only the latest devices will be able to have the capacity or the power or the memory to be able to do so. So it will only be available on iOS 18. That goes without saying. But on iPhone 15 Pros and iPads with an M1 chip or later, or your Macs with a Mac OS Sequoia with an M1 chip or later. So unfortunately, if you've got an older iPhone, if you've got an older iPad or a really old Mac that's got an Intel chip or one of the older chips, you're not going to be able to run any of the Apple intelligence. Now, somebody commented to me, unfortunately, that this is a great way for Apple to make you upgrade all your hardware. The fact is that, unfortunately, in the technology space, processing power has been growing exponentially. The latest chips, as you can see in the new range of PCs with AI coming in, AI is definitely a fundamental break from the past in terms of both architecture, methodology, and manner in which you interact with hardware in a significant way. And fundamentally, the hardware that you use to interact and operate and work with AI has to be at a level that started emerging about 2-3 years ago, but has finally hit mainstream devices across the world in the last year or two. So any technology device, smartphone, we were talking about switching off 2G earlier on dumb phones. I mean, it's almost like using a hammer and a nail compared to using a power drill. But simply put, the technology has moved so considerably that we're going to see some massive changes that will only be possible with the latest versions of hardware. So sad to say, you're going to have to upgrade your hardware to get some of these great benefits. And some of the demos were truly awe-inspiring. There's also, Apple showed a private compute feature. Again, using, when you've got some seriously complex tasks using AI, you can ask your iPhone to check if it can be done locally or on a server. And when you send it off to the server, Apple has got private servers that will run those algorithms on your private, on that server, and no personal data is stored. So it should, and from what I can see, can only be used for private and personal requests. And it certainly does represent a huge shift in the AI space, because privacy has been a huge problem for most of the AI providers, as I said earlier. And for the most part, having played with it both on my MacBook Pro and on my iPhone, I am absolutely amazed how smart it is. Siri finally is starting to sound like a genuinely useful assistant. The voice commands are pretty fluid and easy to use, so you can expect to see that. You can set up automatically generated replies in iMessage or email that are smart. Got to be careful with that, but it can be done. And you can create your own emojis, which have moved. You could do it before, but now you can do it with what they call Gen Emoji, which really takes it to the next level. And there's images in Image Playground. There are so many new apps that are coming out in the nearest future that are going to be pretty insane. I mean, some of the emojis I've created are fully animated. They're incredibly detailed. It's pretty smart. And here's what's also interesting about the whole AI and intelligence thing is that it is rolling out in beta right now in the US, only in English for the most part for now. It'll come to all the other languages, but in South Africa, luckily, there's a pretty solid base of English, and we're not subject to some of the laws. Apple just announced that, unfortunately, due to the certain laws that have come into force where Apple has been designated a gatekeeper technology provider, they're not bringing their AI features in iOS 18 to the European market for now, and they hope to get to it sometime in the early in the new year. For one simple reason, for many reasons, they believe that by opening their platform in the ways that are suggested by the laws in Europe, which are designed to make sure that no one is dominant and no one else can get in the market, and I do appreciate some of the pro sort of parity conditions that make it easier for others to compete, because it's really hard to compete with juggernauts like Google and Apple at anything that they do. But there are sharing provisions and ability to interface, like opening up their app store and all sorts of other things that could potentially breach some of the privacy concerns. So I think it's partially a political game. They're trying to force the European Union to allow them to operate as they do in many other countries around the world. But in the same token, the European Union is pushing really hard for these various sort of privacy laws and equity laws around who can operate where and when. So for example, if you're in Europe and you want to use a browser on your iPhone, it'll automatically offer you to choose any one of the browsers as a default. It won't default to Safari like it does in South Africa and America. You can always go in and figure out how to change it, which is possible. That's been possible for a long while, but it won't overtly ask you the first time you use the new browser, or you use a browser when you set up the new operating system like iOS 18. It won't overtly say to you, oh, by the way, which browser would you like to use? And some of the browsers have AI infused, and that creates all sorts of other issues. So the complexity of integrating AI in so many different ways in your operating system is pretty extreme. And remember that iOS 18 is only coming out sometime in September with iPhone 16. So expect to see a lot of changes, a lot of development, a lot of added benefits, and a lot greater integration of these smart assistant style intelligence based add-ons in the various apps. So we're seeing it in the photo app, we're seeing it in the WhatsApp or whatever type app. Again, Meta have included AI into the WhatsApp. You see it in South Africa. In Europe, you don't see it. So interestingly, that in many ways, privacy and all sorts of things work very well, but there are restrictions in so many ways and so many styles. But expect to see a massive step forward from Apple in terms of integrating AI or Apple intelligence in your phone in the next little while, and expect to see some massive benefits.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Well, welcome back. And moving on from artificial intelligence to analog audio. That's my thing. I'm, for my sins, and a true music lover. I'm not someone who makes music. I'm someone who consumes music. And for many years, and even now, I really do play with exotic audio equipment and high-end audio, which tends to be stereo. I mean, in this day and age of headphones and whatnot, it's pretty unusual and pretty high-end. But technology has infected that space at an incredibly rapid rate. All the streaming services that we use, including, apparently very shortly, our friends at Spotify, are including a high-resolution part of their music system. Now, if you're using a little pair of in-ear earbuds or a pair of moderate headphones or even decent headphones, the difference between ultra high quality streaming services and normal quality streaming services is not huge. I can hear the difference, and most people, when pointed out, can hear it's a little less harsh. It's a little easier to listen to. The bass is maybe a little bit better. And overall, the sound quality of high resolution digital audio is significantly better. But when you are talking about high-end music systems with big amplifiers and big speakers and just generally listening to either classical jazz or human voice, the difference between low fidelity streaming and high fidelity streaming is marked and extremely noticeable. So a simple low resolution MP3 file can sound terrible on a good hi-fi system, whereas a really high resolution 96K 24-bit digital stream can sound pretty pristine and clean. The challenge that most of us have had over the last few years is that we went through the whole, and I age myself considerably now, but we had record players. There's been a big revival in people who insist on the warm analog sound of a record, an old LP with a needle, and you could hear the little crackles and that sort of warm, smooth sound that came of it. And there's a massive growth in nostalgia. You can even buy brand new albums. And there was a magic in the album art and the whole owning of an hour-long music thing rather than just flipping through a sort of digital stream. But that has, for the most part, faded considerably. You know, home theater and that sort of morph things around the TV screen. So the whole industry has changed considerably, but mostly to the point where it's almost impossible to buy audio in any other form other than digital. So the streaming platforms have absolutely become the only way that you can get high quality music. And how do you do that? You use what is called a streaming box. So high-end audio is not quite dead. Streamers have now come online to fill that gap between how did you get your source audio into your fabulous new or old high-end system. And even on a moderate low-end system, a lot of people can stream using Bluetooth to various amplifiers. And again, Bluetooth streaming sometimes is good, sometimes not great. But overall, the quality has always suffered. But what has emerged over the last couple of years, actually, but they've really solidified right now, is what is called a streamer. Now, those streamers can be as little as a couple of thousand rand, as much as 50, 60, 70, 80,000 rand. And essentially, what a streamer does, it allows you to use any form of digital streaming. So whether you're using some form of service in your home, which has got music stored on a hard drive, or whether you're streaming from one of the music streaming platforms, including Apple, directly to your system. It does the streaming. It manages all of that natively within a box. It does the conversion into analog, and the analog signal goes out to your amplifiers and ultimately to your speakers. And you can enjoy music in a really in a way that was super, super, you know, analog, for the want of a better word. And what I came across, and I've been playing with it for the last couple of days in my admittedly old-fashioned analog stereo system, is something called a streaming DAC. And the brand I'd not heard of before, but I managed to obtain it and get it shipped directly to me. It's called a Gustard R26 DAC. And essentially, it looks like any preamp. It's a box. But it has one very interesting feature, and that it's called a discrete R2R DAC. It's a one-bit DAC, and DAC stands for digital to analog converter. And what it does, it takes the digital streaming sound and converts it using a chain of resistors. No ICs, no little computers, nothing of that sort. So it converts it almost in an analog fashion into an analog stream, which is then amplified and sent out to your system. And the benefit of this type of analog to digital conversion is that it's extremely stable, very low noise, and theoretically should keep the analogness of the sound very high. I know that's a little bit of a cop-out, but essentially that is what is offered. And this ability is very clear to see, because I've tinkered with a lot of cheaper and inexpensive streamers, and some of them are really good. You can buy quite a lot of them for around about 2,000 to 4,000 rand, which in the context of a decent quality audio system is not particularly crazy. And all of them will connect the various streaming services natively, either with full screens with little pictures on of the album art, et cetera, or simply allow you to stream directly to an amplifier or any other form of audio system. And that's not the same as having these all fully integrated Bluetooth speakers or like modern day boom boxes, if you want to call them that. This is a whole another, it's a separate system where you've got a preamplifier, you've got an amplifier, you've got either stereo speakers with a subwoofer or without, but it can generally be pretty high end. I've got a pretty high end system with big amplifiers, big speakers. And this device, which is not inexpensive, it sells for about $1,700. So you can get it in South Africa between 30 and 50,000 Rand, depending where you go. But it's called a Gustard, G-U-S-T-A-R-D, R26 Discrete DAC. And my experience that it's as good as some of the units cost 3 to 5 times the price. It is fully digital on the outside, but fully analog on the inside. Got a remote control, and it works seamlessly with any streaming service. And in fact, its technical capabilities are so advanced that even if they double the quality of the streaming services, which is not available yet, but there is talk of ultra super high fidelity streaming services way beyond the current ones, the device should be, one, it's software updatable, and two, it is definitely able to handle any of those streaming platforms right now. It has all the various inputs. It has all the various outputs from balanced to normal RCA outputs. And it is built out of solid aluminium with separate power supplies for the analog and digital section. So it is a real high-end audiophile's dream. And if there are any out there listening to that, it certainly changed for me the whole way that I interacted with my system. I don't have many CDs left, and yet I have a very fancy CD player. I was using other forms of Bluetooth streaming or getting the music into the system. And with this device, it completely revolutionized everything. It sounds high-end. It has incredible bass. It's just so simple to use. You've got 40 million songs. The challenge and the beauty of album art is you are focused only on one thing. But now you've got 40 million songs, most of them in any format, MQA, it doesn't matter what high-end format, and you can stream them all and listen to them all at your leisure in an incredibly convenient way, using your phone to control it, using Rune, whatever, it makes no difference. The system simply works. So check it out. It's called a Gustard R26 Discrete DAC. Google it, you'll find it. And it is pretty revolutionary in terms of what it does. We have to have a quick break for our sponsors, and I'll be back with some hints and tips on how you can clean up your social media.
This is Tech Talk with Stephen Ambrose on 101.9 High FM.
Well, welcome back. And I've just been going on about all this analog stuff and listening to beautiful music over big speakers and analog systems. And we're going to switch all the way back to social media and to your online presence. Now, a lot of talk has been said about all the algorithms that tend to lock you in. And a lot of, you sometimes see in Facebook, these odd, crazy posts where people say, if you post this, it'll reset and you'll suddenly be directed to people you haven't seen for a long time, et cetera, et cetera. The simple fact is that all social media platforms have algorithms that run in the background. They're not super smart, but they tend to watch what you do and reinforce what you do. So if you see a lot of cat pictures and you interact with cat pictures, guaranteed over the next couple of weeks, all you're going to see is endless cat pictures or endless cooking titles or whatever it is that you look at. It would just seem to narrow you down and focus you down that rabbit hole of whatever you were doing without any real concern for what you're truly interested in. And getting out of those little things is a little bit difficult. Now, what you can do, certainly on Facebook, is you can delete your activity, your log. And what that does, it tells the system that whatever you did in the past is not relevant, and they have to start the process again, which will clean up and certainly broaden out and get rid of any of those other crazy comments. And generally, in any app with Facebook, you go into settings and privacy, go to the settings, your Facebook information, and go to the activity log. Just remember, try to get to the activity log and clear the search history. That should give you, not entirely, because that's just one layer of this, but it would certainly clean up your act a lot and allow you to see a lot more things. And it's probably the only definitive way you can sort of clean up your algorithmic recommendations. Exactly the same process refers to X, or formerly known as Twitter. Go to settings and privacy, privacy and safety, and content you see. And you'll see that content you see. You can adjust your interests, explore the settings, delete any histories, and clean up overall to get your timeline to be a little less focused on what you did in the past, because rabbit holes are simply that, rabbit holes. Exactly the same for Instagram, clear search history. The same for YouTube, history and privacy, clear the history. And the same works on your browser. If you're using Google, it doesn't matter which browser you use. Go to settings and privacy, or security, or both, or go down that little path and clear all the cookies and clear all your history. And what you will find is that when you go back in, the adverts and the information you served has completely changed. It'll go back to sort of a default setting and will start then recustomizing as you use it. And I would suggest, certainly on your browser, you do it every couple of months, because you don't even realize it's so insidious. These things come and they keep heading you down that route. And the more you see, the more you click, the more you click, the more you see. And before you know it, that's all you see. And it can be a little bit limiting because the internet is vast. These apps have incredible amounts of useful information, but we all tend to get focused on what we want to focus on. And sometimes that can be a little either depressing or repetitive or not very useful. So remember that in every single app, every single browser, there's either a privacy or activity setting or some sort of safety and other setting, which you can go and clear your history, clear your settings, delete any previous sort of preferences, and start afresh with a whole new look on the world, both on your mobile, on your desktop, and you never know what else you could find out about. It could be pretty exciting. And on that note, I've been told my time is up. We have to wrap it up. So you go clear out your browser settings and meet me back here, same place, same time, on Chai FM. This is Stephen Ambrose for Tech Talk.